Species.
Unite.
Species. Unite.
One of the things that we've noticed is, you know, when these animals repeatedly show up, that's when people really get frustrated. And up to a point where they may leave like loose electrical wires in their field. And when the herd or the animal comes back the next day, they get electrocuted, right?
Yeah.
So you want to keep people from flipping out and doing something crazy, right?
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Dr. Krithi Corinth. Krithi is Chief Conservation Scientist and Executive Director at the Center for Wildlife Studies in Bangalore. She has spent the past 24 years doing research in India and Asia, and much of that research has focused on the many issues surrounding the human side of wildlife conservation. The work that she and her colleagues at the Center for Wildlife Studies are doing is changing everything for the animals and the humans with whom they share land throughout rural India. We in the U.S. could and should learn a thing or two from their work, especially when it comes to building tolerance for wild animals like wolves and creating solutions for sharing the land. Hi, Krithi. Thank you so much in this crazy busy time of your trip to take time out and come talk to me. It's awesome.
Very excited to be here.
I'm very happy to have you here. You have one of the most extraordinary childhoods I've ever heard of. And I don't know if you knew at the time how extraordinary it was, but will you just talk about it a little bit and kind of how you grew up?
So I think I do now acknowledge that I had this amazing childhood, but I think I didn't realize it for the first 30 years of my life. My dad, Dr. Ulaskaranth, is a tiger biologist and conservationist. I grew up in this small town called Mysore, and he started taking me to the jungle when I was a year old. And it's amazing that my mom let him do this, given that I was their only child. And so we did. He was, you know, pretty strict. So, you know, we'd get out there and we'd sit in watch towers and watch animals for hours together. And then later when he started tracking tigers, I would go tracking tigers with him. And when he started to set up camera traps, we'd do camera trapping. We lived in a very basic lab with, you know, tons of skulls of different animals, different scats. It was fine. I think I didn't realize it was amazing. I just kind of thought a lot of kids, you know, looked at skulls and bones and poop. And
when you would see a tiger, because you didn't see them constantly or anything, did you?
No, they're very, very special. They're much harder to see. And, you know, I saw my first one when I was 2 years old with my dad and my granddad. And you don't remember much from your child when you're that young, right? But I still remember where we saw her. And, you know, just it was like sunset. You know, my dad spotted her, obviously. And this amazing tigress just strolling along in this, like, ditch. It wasn't a very long sighting, but I do remember it. And then, you know, just this year in February, I went walking with one of my teams and we saw a tiger on foot. So for me, when people ask, how many tigers have you seen? The answer is always not enough.
When you were with your dad as a kid, would he get excited when you'd spot somebody?
So the thing was, I had to spot it before he did. Then I got bonus points, right? So it was a game. He basically gamified it. So anything I spotted could be a bird, could be a frog, could be a mammal. If I did it before him, you know, then I'd get a little bit of kudos. Otherwise, I had to be dead silent. I couldn't even take books. I couldn't take, you know, at that time we had Walkmans. I couldn't do any of this, right? Just sit with a pair of binoculars. It could be torture because you're sitting there for 6 hours. I don't know. I don't know if you'd find a kid on the planet today who would sit still for 6 hours.
I don't think you could find a kid on the planet today. But so you didn't want to do anything once you kind of grew up a little bit, you didn't think this would be your path?
No, I was actually very sure it wasn't my path, because when people would ask me, I would say, I don't want to be a doctor. I don't want to be an engineer, which is what most good Indian kids were expected to say. And I also said I didn't want to be a wildlife biologist or a speech pathologist, because that's what my parents did. Mainly because I realized that to be a scientist is amazing. You can go out there and study species or study, questions of interest. But to really solve, you need to get into the tough side of conservation. And I saw all the struggles, not just my dad, but all his amazing colleagues and what they faced. And I didn't really want that life.
Yeah. And so what changed you?
I ended up coming to the U.S. As an 18-year-old to do my undergrad at the University of Florida, and had some amazing teachers who got me hooked onto environmental science and geography. So that was the first sort of narrowing down of interests as a 18-19-year-old. Ended up going to the Yale School of Forestry for my master's, and that's when we had to design a research project. And I found myself back in India designing a research project and, crazy field work. I ended up, breaking my knee second day of starting field work.
In the field?
Yeah, because I was driving a Jeep. I shouldn't have been driving it, and lost about a month of field time. But I went back and it was pouring monsoons, very difficult mountainous terrain. But I was just very, very determined that I would collect my data. And spending that time gave me a sense that my interest was actually on the human side and looking at all the problems that people face from wildlife, and can you mitigate those threats and create opportunities. And so that's, I was about 22 years old when I made up my mind that I'm going to become a conservation scientist and then get a PhD and see what I could do.
And what did your dad say?
I think the PhD thing runs in the family. So they were excited that I did end up doing it, but I think they assumed that I would live in the U.S. and become a professor in a university, teach students, publish papers. I don't think they ever imagined that I'd go back and end up,
being the person who's rewilding India. Yeah. Yes.
Trying to.
Yes. You must be happy and very proud.
I hope so.
I hope so too.
My parents are very, I think, in some sense, typical Indian parents. They don't go gushy about anything. So it's, if I get a couple of words of praise, it's good enough.
It's a big deal. I listened to your TEDx talk from a few years ago. You paint such a beautiful picture. You started talking about India way back when, before the wildlife collapse began. Will you talk about just even what that, like what India was like pre-1800s when everything started to fall apart?
So it's interesting because most people don't realize the extent to which wildlife has collapsed, right? And how recent this is. This is not something that happened 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago. It's the last 100, 150 years. And we had the British in India. They maintained very meticulous hunting and natural history records. And they actually accelerated the sport and bounty hunting. Indian Maharajas were also involved, and sort of starting in the 1850s all the way up to the 1950s, for 100 years, people just went out there on horseback, on elephant back, from bullock carts, from cars, and just shot rhinos, bears, tigers, sambar, wild dog, wolves, what have you. So my PhD ended up looking at this historic distribution of animals and how it had shrunk over a 150-year period. And we found that, there were some key factors why some of these species had survived. One was the fact that we did set up a fledgling park system in the 1970s. And for species like tigers and wild dogs, they ended up being refugia, where their populations have not just persisted, but rebounded successfully thanks to the Indian government and NGOs working. But we also found that there are varied levels of cultural tolerance that people have for different animals, right? And when I compare that to people in the US or Europe, there's such hostility towards lynx, towards wolves, towards pumas. And I look at how many losses people in India bear from wildlife. And it's an appreciation for the culture, for the ability that you have to learn to share space with animals.
It's interesting you say that, because this I was on last year, and it's still going on, on this like quest to understand the wolf hatred in the US, because wolves don't actually cause many problems, but they're hated like viciously and violently. And then they're being massacred. But in listening to some of your talks, there's more of a justifiable hatred when there's so much damage mm-hmm. occurring, but there still seems to be a lot more tolerance. But there is a ton of human-animal conflict in India. Yes. And mostly it's elephants, right?
Yes. So I realized very quickly that understanding human-wildlife interactions is something I wanted to get deeply into. Looked into a lot of the scientific literature out there and found that people were doing very localized studies. So you didn't really have an understanding of the scale of the problem. So about 12 years ago, really started to look at human-wildlife conflict across India, did some amazing work with over 700 citizen science volunteers helping us collect data across 3,000 villages, right? On is there conflict? What are the species involved? How do you protect your crops, your property, your livestock? And then does mitigation even work? Fencing, ditches, saris, ginger, bees, all these experiments are being run. And we found that India on average has 80 to 100,000 incidents that are reported to the government for some form of compensation. What we also found was that less than 30% of people were reporting. So the actual number is probably 300 to 400,000 incidents from anything, ranging from pigs killing a few tomato plants to elephants coming and destroying your entire crop, right? But that level of retaliation is low. It's usually when somebody's killed or injured. And there's a lot of tolerance for the large-scale economic losses from losing crops and livestock.
Why aren't or weren't people reporting?
Just the frustration with the system. They live in remote areas. Pictures had to be taken of a certain kind. And, of course, the bureaucracy and the delays and occasional corruption.
When there's a conflict with elephants, say, in a community, is there anything you can do?
One of the things that we've noticed is, when these animals repeatedly show up, that's when people really get frustrated. And up to a point where they may leave, like lose electrical wires in their field. And when the herd or the animal comes back the next day, they get electrocuted, right?
Yeah.
So you want to keep people from flipping out and doing something crazy, right?
Yeah.
It's not very common, but it does happen.
Yeah.
And then it's just, it's horrible for everybody, right?
Yeah. And that's one of your big projects, though, is getting people. Will you talk about that?
Yeah. So after having done research for, good 7-8 years, I started to get frustrated that we weren't really solving anything. We're just documenting all this, right? So in 2015, we launched the Wild Save program. The idea was very simple. A toll-free number circulated at that point to 600 villages around two premier parks, which had a lot of conflict in southern India. And over the last 7 years, the program has now helped over 21,000 people file compensation claims. Some of them have called us once. Some of them have called us 70 times. We've gone 70 times.
And like something really happens time after time after time?
Yeah. Yeah. There are families that have called us 70 times in 7 years, right? And, but they have no choice. That is where they have to live. They have to make a living and they have to protect their livelihoods. We've gotten them access. All of the money comes from the government, over $1 million in compensation. And this year, we finally expanded the program to two more parks. And amazingly, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because of the act to protect and funding set aside to protect elephants and tigers, is supporting work in India to help expand this program to 10 more parks over the next 4 years. So I'm very grateful to U.S. taxpayers
that is incredible.
For caring for Indian wildlife.
That is absolutely incredible that even they're supporting this. You go in. What do you guys actually do?
So they call us. We arrive at the scene. We photograph the damage. There's a whole set of complicated government forms that have to be filled out. A lot of these guys are not literate, so you help them fill the form out. Sometimes we submit this claim. Sometimes they submit the claim. But then we also track it. We keep going back to the offices, checking on the status of what's happening. So it has cut down the processing times for more, which we used to be 6 to 8 months, to less than 2 months today.
It must really have changed the way a lot of people are viewing, like, when these bad things happen.
So what WildSavvy did is then kind of inspired 3 more conservation programs at Center for Wildlife Studies that I designed and then co-implemented with my amazing team. And what it's done is made these guys realize that we may come for the wildlife, but we're going to help them. And we've done it repeatedly in several different ways. First through, you know, conflict compensation, then through an education program, then through a wildlife diseases and public outreach around conflict program, to something really cool now where we're trying to work with farmers to individually rewild parcels of land. It's early days, but we wouldn't have done the NUAS program if we hadn't built the goodwill through the previous 3.
Okay, let's go back to a couple of the other ones before we talk about the rewilding, because that's awesome. But with the education, is it education of kids?
Yes. So I started to notice there were kids in all these villages. They don't have the excitement, happiness, curiosity like I did, or many urban kids do, about wildlife, because you watch Nat Geo and Discovery. And so in 2018, with my friend Gabby Salazar, who I met at the Nat Geo Explorers Festival, we designed a conservation education program that called Wild Chalet, which would go to village schools around parks. Despite the program being on hold for almost 1.5 years because of the pandemic, we've reached 675 schools and almost 30,000 children. So we use sort of art and games and storytelling to get kids to build first empathy, right? Why are you similar to a tiger or a sloth bear or an elephant? What do they need that we also need? And why might conflict arise? And then eventually, if you do see a conflict situation around you, you know, what are the do's and don'ts? And they vary by each animal, right? And so it's gotten kids to appreciate local animals that they see. It's gotten kids to care. And I know this because one of my favorite stories is the fact that we'd been doing WildSavvy for several years, and there were still places we were not getting calls from. The minute we started doing the education program, the kids started telling their parents to call us for help, right? And so then I saw the circular loop between 2 programs who have different staff working on them, but clearly the messaging was working.
Well, and it's amazing too, because I'm sure kids who grow up in rural areas with parents who view wild animals mostly as like pests, right? Like they're big nuisances to their livelihood, but also dangerous and everything else. How else would these kids appreciate them if someone wasn't there to show them?
Yeah, and what used to amuse me is, right, of course they watch Discovery and Nat Geo, and you know, they get excited about kangaroos and penguins and and koalas, and yet didn't quite appreciate that they lived in one of the most amazing parts of the planet with access to these amazing tigers, amazing elephants, wild dogs, gaur, and the recognition that India has amazing large mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles left is something we want to kind of...
Yeah, they're still there. I didn't know India had wild dogs.
Yes, India has 70% of Asiatic wild dogs, right? We are the last hope for wild dogs. We are the best hope for tigers. We're the best hope for Asian elephants on that continent.
Right.
And I think that is our true challenge in the next 20 years, to see in this sort of booming economy the need to provide and uplift so many millions of people in a country like India. Are wildlife going to be on the losing end, or are we going to come up with creative solutions? So there's some kind of, I don't like the word coexistence, but, you know,
why don't
sharing.
You like it?
Because that kind of implies that there's some kind of balance. I think it's very dynamic.
Yeah.
And maybe we can keep it going back and forth without real harm to either end.
Have tiger populations started to go the other way?
Yes. I think for, you know, the government setting aside these protected areas, very significant investments in, you know, conservation and research, you've seen tiger populations rebound in some places. I don't think this is a uniform story.
Yeah.
So where it's been done well, animals have bounced back. And where it's not being done well, you've had tigers blink out in some parts of India, right? So I don't think there's a clear tagline on it.
Sure.
Things are certainly better today than they were 50 years ago. But what is going to happen in the next 10, 20 years is what right. I think about.
And is it poaching of tigers?
Yes. Wildlife trade, particularly pressure from China and some of the other Asian economies, means that we continue to serve as a potential supplier. It's not just tigers anymore. It is otter skins. It's owl's eyes. It's pangolin scales. It's almost become a thing where you may go in for a tiger or an elephant. You've put in the effort. The odds of getting them are so low and the risks are high. So you end up catching all the smaller species. And so there's an threat to a lot of these smaller guys, which, you know, very few people are able to kind of really capture because detection is so hard.
You don't hear enough about poaching in India. I guess here you don't. Back to the program. So you started with three.
The third one, the third program we started was during the pandemic, because having done Wild Seve and Wild Chale, we realized that it wasn't just the kids, even the adults in the communities didn't know how to cope with conflict, right? So we designed this program to kind of go out there, work with community leaders, organizations, frontline health and forest workers who lived right next to these parks. As we were about to launch, the pandemic hit. So my team, along with the rest of the planet, got locked up in field bases or in cities. And I decided that we shouldn't just be looking at conflict. We should also look at diseases because of the proximity of livestock, wildlife, and people. And so other than COVID, we found five other common, what we call zoonotic diseases.
What are they?
The diseases are rabies, which is very common.
Yeah.
Scrub typhus, leptospirosis, Nipah, which actually originally came from Malaysia into India several years ago. And then this very rare disease called Kyasanur forest disease, which transmits between monkeys and people. But it's restricted to a very small part. So we built out the program so the outreach workshops would do disease and conflict. And as soon as we were able to get out from September 2020 till date, my amazing team have gone to 60 of the 70 protected areas in the Western Ghats. We've done close to 800 workshops and reached almost 35,000 frontline people, right? What it's done is now as scientists, we're going to analyze the data. It's going to allow us to sort of spatially map where emerging hotspots for conflict and disease exist for an entire biodiversity hotspot. And it's also given us access to people on the ground who now will call us or if they see something unusual, or we can call and ask if something strange is going on, right? And so you have many more eyes and ears on the ground keeping an eye on stuff. I think that will go a long way to look at future threats.
And now the new program, which is the rewilding.
So we've looked at sort of what kind of mitigation is possible, right? In conservation, we spend a lot of time investing in solutions. And as I mentioned earlier, they could be electric fences, solar fences, ditches, bee fencing, chili fencing. And a lot of the research we did showed that most of this doesn't work. So there has to be a set of solutions where you allow passage of the animals, where you start to grow things that the animals will not be attracted to. And a big part of the challenge where we work is people grow sugarcane, they grow ragi, they grow rice, vegetables, fruits, all very yummy things that people and animals want to eat. So we're trying to now get people to switch their livelihoods to growing tree species that are native to the area, that over a period of time will give them fruits, will give them seeds, will give them other products, bark, leaves, medicinal things, and then eventually some of them being timber trees. So that eventually you're not growing things that animals will come out for. It doesn't mean that animals won't come, because these are farms that are in the migratory paths will still always see some number of animals, but you're not attracting them with your crop.
Well, they're not choice. Coming for lunch.
Yeah.
Right. They're just passing
they may
by.
Yeah, exactly. So we want to transition that from hanging out and having lunch and dinner to, you know, just passing.
Passing by. What's the reaction been like?
It's very early days. Yeah. And as a scientist, I'm just very cautious. The reaction from farmers is that they want to try this, right? They've tried everything else.
Right.
Nothing else is working. And they know these are families we've worked with, you know, because of the Save program. So they know that we're trying and we mean well and we'll help. So it's very, very early days, but I'm excited about it.
But like when they're growing sugarcane, they can make money.
Yes.
Right? But if you're growing trees, what do you do?
You can make money, because if you grow fruiting trees, you will get fruits. You can get bark. You can get oils. So we're trying to give them a mix of tree species that will generate income slowly. Some things will take time. Some things will grow fast.
Okay.
And so can you supplement and eventually replace the agricultural income with tree-based income?
And they've signed on, though? Some
yeah.
have signed on?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure if everyone's eating your sugar cane, you know, like yeah. you're not making a lot of money.
And you're losing all of it.
Yeah.
And you're a farmer who makes, you know, $1,200 a year. And one conflict incident means, you know, you've lost 30 to 40% of it.
Yeah.
It's, you're going to try other things eventually.
I know it's in the beginning, but is it a very small amount of farmers you're starting with? Or?
We started with 500 farmers this
year. That's a lot.
Year. Yeah, but we want to work with 10,000 over the next 3 years.
Wow.
So, yes.
all close to
yeah,
the
all
parks,
close to,
right?
So you build like a patchwork, in some sense like a patchwork quilt,
right.
right? Where you create small refugia where animals can hang out and then move on.
And so go back to your TED Talk for a minute, because so when you were talking about what do you call it? Whenever the collapse of wildlife is what you call it.
Yeah.
Pre the collapse, India, there was millions of animals, right, roaming around.
Oh, at least hundreds of thousands. You certainly okay. had hundreds of thousands of tigers, and we've been reduced to less than 4,000 today, right?
Yeah.
You had thousands of lions. You have less than 800 lions. We have one population of lions left, right? So it is very dramatic. And, you know, I only got to go to Africa recently, and the few countries I've been to, I'm just blown away. And I'm so deeply envious of all my friends who are doing amazing work in Tanzania and Botswana and Kenya and Mozambique, Namibia. But I realized that, one, they have a lot more wildlife left. And secondly, they have far fewer people to contend with. But eventually, they will also hit a situation where you're seeing the hard decisions and trade-offs that we see in Asia today, right?
Sure.
And I'm hoping that some of the solutions that we are developing in India will now, we're happy to share what we are doing and get them out to other places. So you build the systems to support people before it becomes a sort of a real big problem.
Well, and before it becomes kind of a war.
Yeah.
Because animals are never going to win if it's a war.
Yeah.
No, and we could use some of your solutions too, because we certainly could, especially in the West. So, because India is so dense. It's like a very tricky,
challenging. We have 600
challenging
people per square kilometer around some of these parks that we work in, right? And I mean, in Namibia, I went, like the entire country is like 8-9 million people. You can go for days without seeing a human being, you know.
But you'll see a lot of elephants.
Yes. And zebras and yeah. giraffes and yeah. everything else.
Yeah. No, I could see the jealousy. But it's true, this is, because also Africa's losing habitat.
Yeah,
like,
and
so
lions
fast.
Are in trouble. Cheetahs are in trouble. You never imagine African elephants would be in trouble, but they are.
Yeah.
And you're sort of, I'm seeing a precursor to what's happened in India, kind of unfortunately unfolding in parts of Africa today.
And that's, I think, the thing that really hit home for me when I heard your TED Talk was, I didn't think about India before,
You just think about the present.
You think about the present. And that's what India is, right? Versus we're living in, I mean, Africa definitely had a lot more animals 100 years ago, but we're still living kind of in the before right now as we watch the present coming to attack it.
And you need the past to wake up. You need to be shocked into realizing that all of this has happened in a very short time span.
Right.
India, and this should be India had 250 million people in 1900, right? Which is slightly less than the current population of the US. And we've grown fivefold in 120 years. Yet, we are holding on to some of these animals, which is a story that needs to be celebrated, understood, and supported.
The fact that you still have so many is incredible. But it is such a story for the entire world to pay attention to.
And a wake-up call that things could get far worse and there are ways to make sure we don't go down that path.
It's terrifying and astonishing at the same time. You know, like, and I really, I'm sure if I didn't think about it, not a, like you, people just don't think that way of the before and the now. You've been in this for like 25 years or so.
24
years. Have you seen like a shift in just the people in general in terms of appreciating the wildlife in India?
I don't know about appreciating. I do feel like there's some intergenerational shifts going on where older people who have deep ties to the land respect the fact that you do share water, land, resources with wildlife. With younger generation, I worry there's a deep disconnect from nature. Because maybe you don't spend as much time outdoors. Maybe you don't, you know, you just see them as problems and not sort of creatures that you have to coexist with. Right. And so that generational shift is something that worries me.
Yeah.
But then our Wild Chalet kids, like we've seen their eyes light up. We've seen them change with just the 4 sessions and 15 hours that we spend with each classroom, right? So I know it's possible.
And mostly you're just getting them excited and you're getting them to understand, right?
Yeah, a little bit of why tigers matter, why elephants matter, why do we look at wild spaces, why kids should care, right? And to build empathy is hard, but can you just instill a few things that carry them through life into adulthood where when they're faced with situations, you know, this triggers positivity as opposed to negative reactions?
We're so happy that you're doing this because you're like a role model for the world.
I'm just kind of representing 79 other people back in India who are very much along with me for the ride.
Sure, so. But I'm just saying the fact that your whole organization exists because the world can learn so much from what you guys are doing. So thank you. And thank you for today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you.
You as well. To learn more about Krithi and to learn about the Center for Wildlife Studies, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We'll have links to everything. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you have a spare moment and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to support the show, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Bethany Jones, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performs today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.